And Dr. Lynch is associate professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, where he is also director of the Institute of Middle East Middle East Studies and the Middle East Studies program. So there are two programs. He is the author of several books on Middle East politics and media, including Voices of the New Arab Public, Al Jazeera, Iraq, and Middle East Politics Today. Also, Revolution in the Arab World, Tunisia, Egypt, and the Unmaking of an Era. And his most recent book on the Arab Spring is Arab Uprising, the Unfinished Revolutions of the New Middle East. Dr. Lynch is also a prolific blogger. He's writing now a blog for foreign policy, and before that, he was authoring the influential blog Abu Ardvak.ran for 7 years, I think.
How many years?
Until 2009, but I think it's still Abu Ardvak is still active on Twitter. So, okay, welcome, Dr. Lynch.
Thank you. All right, thanks, and thank you all for sticking out this long day. So I knew that Zainab and Sahar were going to speak before me, and because I know their work and I know them, and they're wonderful, I had a pretty good idea of what they were likely to say. And so the talk that I decided to prepare is going to be a bit more, shall we say, pessimistic than theirs. And I thought they did an outstanding job. It's empirically rich and theoretically sophisticated in laying out all the many ways in which new media have empowered these different forms of activism. The question that I want to put out there is one which I think the time has come for people working on this area to really begin to take seriously. And that is that if we are willing to give a certain amount of credit, and I do believe we should give a certain amount of credit to social media in terms of helping to spark and shape the dynamics of the Arab uprisings, the revolutions, the Arab Spring, whatever you want to call it, then do we also need to give it some share of the blame for how badly things have gone over the last year and a half? In other words, are the same mechanisms, drivers, and the dynamics that we saw making the Arab revolutions possible, are they actually related to the negative turn we've seen across the region? If you look at the radical, massive political dysfunction in Egypt, what my colleague Nathan Brown famously called the stupidest transition in history, you know, where it seems like every single political actor, every time they're given a chance to make a choice, they make the wrong choice. And, you know, they write a bad constitution, they mismanage elections, they change the rules, they dissolve their elected parliament. I mean, you could hardly imagine a worse managed transition. You look at Tunisia, one of the great success stories for the first year or so, and then steadily kind of retreating back into polarization, into institutional dysfunction. The long-promised constitution keeps being pushed off. And as one of the guests mentioned today, a leader of an opposition party getting gunned down in the streets, which is, you know, in Tunisian terms, is extremely unusual. There's no history of assassination of political violence in Tunisia. You look at Yemen, which had one of the most, one of the most vibrant and creative of the protest movements. It's very much stalled. You had this, the imposed transition to a new president, but I don't think anybody would look at Yemen today and see a success story. You still have protesters camped out in Change Square, but I think most people would agree that the nature of the mobilization there has radically changed. Bahrain, we heard about, absolutely crushed. A short-term success for the government. I mean, they cleared the streets. They bulldozed Pearl Roundabout, and they carried out a systematic campaign of torture, repression, and sectarian crackdown, which is really, and I would put it in the upper ranks of the league tables in terms of nasty things governments have done, probably buying themselves a death sentence in the long term, the regime, I mean. But in the short term, I think nobody would look at the Bahraini uprising and recognize it from the way it looked 2 years ago today. And again, you can look around the region, and what you see are stalled transitions, frustrated uprisings, disenchanted activists, and this is a largely regional process. And that hasn't even gotten us yet to Syria, which is the kind of the gaping wound at the heart of the Arab world today. Peaceful protests turned into a brutal insurgency, civil war, massive campaign of state killing and repression, with the conservative estimate of the UN of 60,000 dead, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of refugees. And again, what we see is something which is, I think, very different from the optimism which many of us shared in the early days of the Arab Spring. Now, I would not argue that social media is to blame for all of these things. In fact, what we're seeing is clearly the unfolding of deep structural political issues. Political transitions are never easy. Go back and ask Eastern Europe how their transitions felt in 1991. Go ask the Ukrainians how their transition felt in 2006. Go and ask, you can go through any transition, political transition from authoritarian rule that we've ever had. These things are difficult. It's difficult to dislodge ruling elite, not just a regime, but a system. It's difficult for a fragmented, scattered civil society to find societal consensus and agree on the rules of the game. It's hard to avoid polarization, especially when the economy is collapsing and there's fear and mistrust and uncertainty about the rules. This is all the deep structure of what's going on right now. And social media, I think, just as you heard, I think, from Zeynep before, social media, it matters at the margins for this, right? It helps with organization. It helps with mobilization. It helps with communication. It doesn't cause the revolutions, but it does have an effect. One way that I like to phrase this is that social media matters at the margins, but most politics happens at the margins, right? So you have, Barack Obama wins a landslide over Mitt Romney. He wins by 43% to 47%. That's 3% swing, the election changes. That's politics at the margins, right? So the difference between getting 10,000 people into the streets and getting 100,000 people into the streets, if you're talking about a population of 85 million in Egypt, the difference between 10,000 and 100,000, that's the margins. But politically, it makes all the difference in the world. So saying that the impact of social media is at the margins is not a contradiction to saying that it matters. It's the same thing. And I think it's very important for us to keep this in mind as we kind of go through this. So I did have a whole series of points that I wanted to make about the positive contribution of social media to the outbreak of the revolutions. But quite honestly, I think Zeynep and Sahar covered those very, very well. And I'm just going to leave it as given, leave it as stated. I agree with most of what they said. And I'm happy to go back and talk about it a bit more. I want to dive right in to 10 ways in which we could make an argument that social media has contributed at the margins to the current stalemate, stagnation, polarization, and violence, and try and get a full account of how social media might be transforming politics. And again, I say this as someone who loves social media. I mean, I love Twitter. I'm all over Twitter. And I've been immersed in internet digital activism from the beginning. But I think as analysts, we need to be able to separate out our analysis from our advocacy and what we want to see happening from what actually is happening. And so very few of the things I'm about to say are what I would consider to be definitive. But I think they're questions that more than answers. So let me walk through them one by one, 10 brief points. First, let me start with the questions that consumed much of the first two sessions, questions about the mechanisms driving mobilization and facilitating collective action. And I think that we heard a really good account of most of those, the ways in which social media allows for the lowering of transaction costs, for communicating information. All those things are right. But I think that it's also generally understood that social media is better for mobilization than it is for normal politics, right? It's better at finding ways to coordinate episodic, issue-based action than it is for kind of the harder more, let's be honest, boring work of organizing political parties, of building grassroots support, of building constituencies and figuring out a way to get thousands of voters to the polls at a particular time. There's something about social media and the specific things it does in mobilization which make it, I think, uniquely and actually quite powerfully effective at helping people with a diverse range of interests and relatively limited prior contact and organization to come together around these common issues. And so, for example, as we heard, you can get people who are leftists, Muslim Brotherhood activists, liberals, women, human rights campaigners, poorly educated manual laborers, soccer fans. You can get them all together to come and say, down with Hosni Mubarak. The regime must go. That's easy. That's what it's good for. You don't need to have a positive agenda, right? What you need is a negative one. A single, easily understood demand, which is emotionally powerful, clearly resonant, and one on which it's almost the lowest common denominator kind of agreement. And that, I think, we've seen work in many places. I mean, I think that the Zainab's point was actually a really good one, that in many ways, I would argue that the absence of an effective organized leadership probably saved the Egyptian revolution in Tahrir Square, because there was nobody who could negotiate it away, right? If there had been an effective leadership, then when Omar Suleiman called in the wise men, they would clearly have bargained it away if they could. But they couldn't, because none of them really controlled the street at that time. Now, again, that's good in the moment of enthusiasm. But then the moment of enthusiasm passes. And now what do you have? You have those movements disaggregated and their individual interests coming back to the fore. And the mistrust and the different agendas and all of the different things which those disaggregated groups were able to shed when they came out into the streets in pursuit of a common goal came back when you see a return to normal politics. I would say that there's a pretty good case to be made that the same things which were extremely powerful strengths during the days of the revolution became fatal weaknesses after the revolution, or at least after the fall of Mubarak. Leaderless revolutions are just really bad at then finding ways to organize themselves around a coherent political strategy. They're bad at figuring out which of the wonderful celebrity and brilliant activists who all have 50,000 followers on Twitter will be the one to stand for parliament. They're not good at that sort of thing. And again, this is not a criticism of them. This is simply built into the structure of a leaderless organization. I think, Sahar, your points about what we mean by leaderless are really good and really interesting to think through. But the fact is that these are individuals and who are coming at this as activists, not as democratic politicians, not as people who want to become the next kind of working a member of parliament or that sort of thing. And so I think that one thing is kind of built into this then is that we're looking at how social media might be contributing to the problems that we're facing right now. I think part of it is rooted in the very same things which made it a strength during extraordinary moments, turns it into a weakness at less extraordinary moments. I would say less extraordinary, but at these like slower, more grinding kinds of moments. Okay, a second kind of part which comes in that comes out of this then, kind of point number two, follows, I think, much more directly from something Zahar was saying, and I think which is very important, is that what developed, particularly in Egypt over that previous decade, was, I think, a very powerful shared common identity as activists and as revolutionaries and as people who are deeply committed to a mode of action, to becoming the voice of the streets, to getting out into Tahrir, to fighting the police. And again, these are all things which are extremely important parts of the activist toolkit. This is part of why so many activists in Egypt would get extremely angry when they would be interviewed by people who would say, tell me how Facebook made the revolution, tell me how Twitter made the revolution. And they would say, no, They didn't make the revolution. We made the revolution. We were out there fighting. We were out there risking our lives. We were out there coming up with all these creative things. Facebook and Twitter were tools that we used. And you hear this again and again and again when you talk to people. And I think the point that I would make here, this kind of second point, is that when you have an identity like this, which is deeply invested in that particular mode of action, then being asked to give up that mode of action when and return to normal politics just isn't very appealing. The idea of leaving the streets behind and becoming, you know, a bureaucrat, or becoming an elected representative from some district, or going back and working and filling out forms at an NGO fundraiser, you know, raising funds, that sort of thing. You do those things, but that's not congruent with the identity. There's a certain deep commitment, which is extremely admirable, that you see among many of these activists, but it is not the same commitment which is really compatible with a return to normal politics. I would say that there's also a pretty interesting, kind of philosophical and theoretical perspective on politics, which is common among many of, the Egyptian activists in particular, which is that I think many of them don't really believe in democracy per se. That liberal democracy is not the end point to which they aspire. They want revolution. They want to bring about, depending on who they are, and there's all these individuals with different aspirations, but if you're a revolutionary socialist, then liberal democracy is not really what you're looking for, right? And in fact, liberal democracy is more likely to be seen as kind of this is a sham, the face of bourgeois society, which is basically pacifying the demands of workers and laborers and kind of mystifying the reality of continued domination. Why would you go home and stop fighting just because you've had elections if that's what you think is going on? And I think we need to be much more aware, and I think that in many ways we did a disservice, we kind of collectively, kind of outside observers external to Europe, in imposing a democracy activist frame on people who are activists for a wide range of reasons. So again, now this is my second broad point, is that if number one is that the social media itself had distinctive mechanisms which tended to empower activism, the second is that the kinds of activists which tended to be, which were empowered, were they took on this very distinct identity. This is why I wrote in my book, and I still believe, and I think we're seeing it right now, that regardless of whether there's a successful transition to democracy, I expect many of the same people who were protesting in Tahrir Square 2 years ago, 5 years from now, they'll still be protesting in Tahrir Square. Regardless of whether there's a transition to consolidated democracy or not, because in a sense, protest is what they do, and they don't see democracy as a compelling or successful endpoint. And so that's point number two. Number three is then kind of related to that. Actually, no, it isn't. I'm just going to jump over one real quickly. Point number three is something which came up, and both Sahar and Zainab mentioned this, and we've written about it a lot in reports we've done for USIP, which is that one of the big ways in which social media mattered during the Arab Spring, and which it's mattered at various other points, has been in its ability to frame kind of the mainstream media and mass media coverage of what's happening. And this has been an extremely important part of it. If you think about it, you know, Facebook groups might have 10,000 members. Khaled Said gets up to, what, 100,000, a million? The YouTube channels that the Syrian activists post on, often the videos are only seen by, you can go look, you can see how many times they've been viewed. It might be 500 times, 700 times. But when those images, when those videos, when those ideas, when those frames make the jump into mainstream media, they reach tens of millions of people. They get to Al Jazeera, and they reach 40 million. And again, Zainab's absolutely right that this was a coherent media ecology. Now, when there was a tight synchronization between the social media and the mainstream media, this became an extraordinarily potent force. where you would have almost a direct feed between, call them citizen journalists, call them activists, I don't much care, the people producing content, ideas, videos from the ground, having almost an unfiltered stream into mass media broadcasts. And that let them punch in way, way, way beyond their weight. And that, I think, is a big part of the secret of the power of social media, not necessarily inside of Egypt, for example, although it did have that too. Think how many Egyptians were watching Al Jazeera as opposed to seeing this stuff directly. But I would say especially outside of Egypt, where how do people know what's going on? They're watching TV. Or they're some of them are following Twitter feeds, but most of them are watching TV. I mean, right up to, I'm sure, I don't know how many of you have seen the famous pictures of President Obama and his national security team watching Al Jazeera in the Situation Room. I mean, that's where they're getting their framing, their understanding of what's happening in the country. Now, I think one of the things which then happens after that initial moment of enthusiasm, when you have that tight synchronization between social media and broadcast media, is that it begins to break down. The mainstream media moves on. They get bored. You know, Tunisia was exciting for a few weeks, and then, you know, everyone forgets about Tunisia. Egypt was exciting, and then people then kind of stopped being covered until the next time that there were you know, protests and killing and riots. But it was episodic rather than continuous. And you get into these battles for attention and these battles for framing. What also happens, though, and I think this is less recognized, is that I think that that broadcast media and print media, they start to get more skeptical of what they're getting from activists. They start, basically credibility starts to be eroded. In Egypt, you know, I think I've mentioned this before, but in other places, but I mean, I was really struck the first time that I was driving around Cairo, totally calm, totally normal, nothing happening, and I'm following my Twitter feed and I'm seeing devastation, mayhem, you know, the state's about to collapse. And I'm sure that's how it felt for people who are in Tahrir Square and fighting police in Tahrir Square. But outside of Tahrir, it didn't feel that way at all. And that's like just one of many examples where you have kind of exaggeration, hyperbole, kind of people caught up in the enthusiasm of the moment. But then over time, you get this kind of the little boy who cried wolf problem, where people look at it and they stop taking it at face value. The synchronization breaks down. The transmission breaks down. People start looking at it more cautiously, more critically, more, skeptically. And again, this doesn't mean that the broadcast, that the transmission completely disappears. There's still that, but it's not as perfectly in tune as it was in the period that Zeynep was describing. So I think that the credibility issue becomes a big one and kind of breaking the impact. The fourth thing that I want to mention then is that there's a common idea about social media or about the internet that the more stuff that goes online, the more voices are heard. And basically, the proliferation of information means that kind of everybody has equal access and all that. And of course, we know that's bunk. It's not true at all. That when you get to a certain level, a certain amount of information, nobody can keep up. Nobody can process it, which gives considerable power to the curators and the gatekeepers. And I would actually say that paradoxically, the proliferation of free information on Twitter, on the internet, generally speaking, has probably given more rather than less power to the people who have either been appointed or have seized the mantle of gatekeeping. So Andy Carvin of NPR, for example, during the peak of the Arab uprisings, when he was curating Twitter feeds and kind of basically serving as almost the Twitter narrator of the Arab Spring, you know, he did, I know him, he's a great guy. He was doing the best job that any human being could have done at trying to navigate these hundreds of thousands of tweets and figuring out what's going on and what's credible and what's not. But, I mean, the fact is that anybody in that position is going to have cognitive shortcuts. He's going to trust some people more than other people. He's going to retweet some people more than other people. And it creates a very distinctive, I mean, they don't call it curated for a reason. Some voices get heard, some voices don't. In Syria, you have tens of, you know, I don't want to put a number on this, but let's just say you get hundreds of videos a day posted to YouTube by citizens recording things that are happening in Syria. Three or four of those seem to find their way to the BBC or to Al Jazeera. Well, why? Why those three and not three other ones? Why three images of peaceful protest instead of three images of people throwing stones at people from a different sectarian group? Why images of the regime shooting at protesters and not images of protesters shooting at the regime? And the key thing here is that, generally speaking, if you go and look for yourself, those videos on all sides are available to be seen if you go and look for them. But at some point in the transmission, you end the transmission between online and broadcast, once again, you see that curation process. Maybe it's being done by editors. Maybe it's being done by the activists themselves. One very, very smart and effective Syrian activist, he told a story. Actually, this is in public. This was at a USIP conference that I hosted, so I can tell it here, too. And he was describing how a young woman, smuggled video footage out of some protest. She smuggled the video, the memory card, out of her bra, gets it across the border. He's in Lebanon at the time, and he looks at it, uploads it, and he was like, oh my God, this is horrible. We've got people chanting sectarian anti-Alawi chants. We don't want people to know about this. Smash. Destroys the memory chip. But there were other people at the protest. They also took video footage. They uploaded it to YouTube. He discovers it on YouTube, and he says, what are we going to do? So he goes back, and every day he goes back to YouTube and he checks. And after 7 days, the video had 10 views, all from him. And by his choice to not link to it, to not post it on the Facebook page that he was administering, to not push it out to journalists, he effectively buried what was objectively part of the story. Again, this is not criticism of him. This was very smart of him. He effectively was managing the communication, managing the image, managing the frames. But this is a very different idea than what we conventionally have of kind of the natural free flow of information with the truth emerging through the reasoned exchange of argument and the like. And I think it's just important for us to understand how this curation, as the stakes have gone up, the importance of curation has also gone up. And at the same time, the skepticism of the journalists and the editors has gone up. And these are all related to each other, and I think it's all rooted in the same basic process. Okay. Boy, I got a bunch more. This is only the beginning, okay? So number five, I'll go a little bit faster because I want to be sure there's plenty of time for discussion. Point number five is that one of the effects of the proliferation of information and just this vast upsurge of direct access into places like Egypt or Yemen was, I think, it created a belief among many people that they really understood what was going on. That, in essence, they suddenly knew so much about the internal debates, the personalities, you know, these activists who are you know, so attractive in so many ways, brave, courageous, and everything. But in a sense, it's very easy to be fooled by the illusion of full information, because what they actually had was more information, often carefully presented, for public consumption, but still, let's say, pretty good information about a very small slice of Egyptians or Yemenis or Bahrainis or Tunisians or the like. And so we came to know an enormous amount about the Facebook youth, of the these people in Tahrir Square, and we're all the better for knowing them. But we didn't learn nearly as much about what the soldiers were thinking or what the police officers were thinking, or what the Muslim Brothers were thinking, or what the Salafis were thinking, or what the people on a couch who decided to come out into the square to join the first protest they had ever joined in their lives and actually made the difference between success and failure in Tahrir Square, we don't know what they were thinking. In other words, this is the famous, this is like the drunk looking for his keys, and where does he look? He looks under the street lamp, because that's what he can see. And he can see pretty well under that lamp, and he might even have the illusion that he is doing a really good job of researching, looking for his keys, because he's looked in every area that's illuminated, but there's a whole dark street out there of which he knows nothing. And I think that's one of the pitfalls analytically which many people suffered by virtue of a reliance on social media. Number six is something which Zeynep alluded to at the end of her talk, which is that one of the iron laws of kind of social media environments or any kind of user-generated, user-driven space is the tendency towards polarization and informational bubbles. This is the homophily argument that she was making. And what this basically means is that people end up seeking out like-minded people and kind of clustering into these groups. This isn't unique to Egypt or Tunisia. This has been observed in almost every study of online environments. It's one of the closest things we have to an empirical generalization about behavior in such environments. And I think that a very good case can be made that social media didn't cause but contributed to the observable polarization of politics in these countries, where what you see is that many of the most vocal, the most influential, the most active commentators increasingly were self-sorting. Islamists over here, their adversaries over here. Among the activist communities, they would circulate every story which was critical of the Muslim Brotherhood, would immediately be tweeted, retweeted. No time for fact-checking. Let's just everybody retweet it really, really quickly and add on snarky comments. You know what we do in online. I mean, this is how we behave online, right? That's what we do. And sounds right. It's got to be right. But then social facts are created. The Islamists are doing the same thing on their side. And as a result, it almost felt over the last 6 months that there's almost two different Egypts out there, almost mutually irreconcilable narratives and understandings of what is going on, and very little dialogue going on between the two sides. If you go back a year ago, year and a half ago, you would still see Muslim Brothers and secular activists sitting down and arguing with each other over tea in person and online, much less of that now. Dehumanization has really kicked in on both sides. The Muslim Brothers are sheep and robots, and the liberal activists are agents of Western imperialism. And they basically, the center has become no man's land, and you've got these two entrenched camps hurling rhetorical bombs at each other across the trench. But what you're not getting is the kind of this ideal we once had of kind of free reason discourse taking place between all these different people. And again, I don't think that social media has caused this. I think there's deep underlying drivers of it, but I think it's encouraged it. It's amplified it, and I think that it's very difficult to miss observably. It's very difficult to miss that this is going on. Number seven is that we tend to focus on the ways in which positive energy flows through social networks. I mean, nobody who was paying attention at the time can forget how exhilarating it was when Ben Ali fell in Tunisia, and everybody across the region is just like gripped with this fever of, we're next, we can do this, change is possible. And so I think that you get a lot of studies then of how positive emotions and positive expectations are driven through these social media channels. But of course, negative emotions flow just as easily. Hate flows just as easily as respect, probably easier. And I think that as things have objectively turned worse, you've seen those negative flows having the same level of intensity. I think Syria is the most obvious example of this, where it's just the division that comes out of Syria, the images of death and destruction, these horrible graphic images. I mean, these spread like wildfire through social networks, just like the earlier positive images do. And so I was having this conversation with a very, very serious, very, very thoughtful Syrian activist who does a lot of work in curating these things. And I don't know how many of you follow this stuff, but do you remember, if you follow this even casually, you might have seen this image of the six-year-old girl in a bridal dress, like a bridesmaid's dress, with her head blown off, right? Do you remember this? How many of you see this? You're like, you know, you open up your Facebook page to drink your coffee, and this is what you see. And it's like, Jesus Christ. I mean, you can't unsee something like that. Then what is the effect of that? I think for them, their decision to post it and circulate it was that it would generate outrage. It would show people how brutal Assad was and compel people to act. But for many people, I think it had the reverse effect, saying, this is awful. This just has to stop. I don't want any part of this. Right? Some negative, some positive. And the point is that we can't assume that only the positive expectations and emotions flow through these networks. Anybody who spent any time on this knows that it's not the case. Okay, number eight is that this deterioration of public space was not entirely passive. And both of you talked a little bit about this. But in fact, we do know that regimes struck back hard. Once they began to take the threat seriously, they found ways to respond. And I'm not going to elaborate. You both talked a bit about how this was done. But just the one example that I like to use is the Bahraini eggs, where there was a very robust and strong support for the Bahraini uprising on Twitter. And then the regime saw that as a threat, and all of a sudden, hundreds, even thousands of eggs appear, anonymous accounts with no followers and no clear identity. And anytime you post a tweet about Bahrain, you're suddenly, if you're reasonably prominent and have a certain number of followers, every time you tweet about Bahrain, you suddenly get 100 at replies of people hurling abuse at you, calling you horrible names, polluting your feed, making it impossible to kind of ignore the complete, they change identities constantly, so you can't just block them. And as a result, it becomes almost impossible to discuss Bahrain on Twitter. And a lot of people, including Andy, essentially gave up trying. Sultan al-Qasimi, the same thing, basically just gave up trying because, you know, it just wasn't worth the cost. Online spaces emerge. Online spaces can be destroyed. And regimes learned that you can destroy them if that's helpful to you. Okay. Number nine, just very quickly, is that one of the great ways in which I think social media helped the Arab Spring, those dizzying early months, was the way that it unified the entire Arab world, this sense that everybody was in it together, that there was this single narrative of the people challenging regimes. And this is all the stuff that they were talking about, especially Zainab, about how you get, you know, Yemenis are following, you know, Egyptian hashtags, and, you know, they're holding up signs that are the same signs that you saw in Tunisia. You saw this incredible unification of Arab attention and the Arab narrative. And that was extremely powerful at the time. That's largely faded and been reversed. Part of it's for a good reason. You know, as you get politics returning to Egypt, Egyptians are more focused on Egypt than they are on Yemen. I mean, they're more concerned about getting their revolution right than they are about cheering the Yemenis on. Part of it is negative, in the sense that issues become divisive. Almost everybody on social media, it appeared, was in favor of bringing down Hosni Mubarak. I would say opinion on Bashar al-Assad is split 50-50 in an intensely polarized personal way. And so you get fragmentation. You get everybody going back to their own countries and having their own political battles and political wars, and then you lose that unification of political space. Finally, the last point that I want to make is just simply Syria. I mean, I just put it at Syria. And again, online social media didn't create Syria, obviously. Although, if you look at the early period of Syria's peaceful uprising, you see a pretty strong and interesting role for social media in trying to shape and promote the existence of those protests, you know, trying to, you know, demonstrate that there were protesters active in Damascus. Even if it was only 10 people, still, they would be able to film it, get the images out, and shape it. But I would say the reason that I bring up Syria is simply that if Egypt was the epicenter of kind of Arab Spring dynamics, optimism, unity, possibility of peaceful revolutionary change, Syria's the opposite of all those things. And I think it really has had a deeply polluting, depressing, and negative effect on how social media grapples with politics across the region. It's just, I mean, the difference between, kind of this compressed, relatively positive experience of Tahrir Square and day after day of seeing images of hundreds of people killed and refugees and seemingly unstoppable suffering just radically changes everything. And I think that as we start thinking about how social media is going to matter politically in the coming years, I think we can't escape that. I think Syria is going to be having this effect for quite some time to come. Okay, so that's quite a litany of negatives. And I'm going to be like the opposite of Zainab now, who basically gave you a highly optimistic talk and then ended on a note of pessimism. I just gave you a very pessimistic talk, and I'm going to end on a note of optimism, which is that these are all kind of, I think, hypotheses we need to explore, trends that we can observe, and things which have to be seen as a useful corrective to many of the narratives of the Arab Spring. At the same time, I remain broadly optimistic about the structural impact of this of the new media on Arab politics. I think that the bottom line is that the combination of new broadcast media, social media, the internet, and kind of a new citizen ethos of engagement and articulation of their views, there's no going back on this. I think this is a genuinely structural change. Authoritarian regimes are not all immediately going to topple and be replaced by democracies or anything else, but I think there's no way for them to go back to the way Arab dictatorships worked for so many years, where they could control the flow of information into their country, prevent the expression of negative opinion. I mean, let me take just one example to show you why I still have so much hope for what this means, is Saudi Arabia. Right? I mean, Saudi Arabia is a country where there's been no revolution, there's very little hope for a revolution, and it remains one of the most repressive and human rights violating and really nastiest kind of domestic political systems on earth. And yet, there's now over 3 million Saudis on Twitter. And they, unlike some of the cases I was talking about before, where Twitter was concentrated in a relatively narrow cosmopolitan urban elite, in Saudi Arabia, it actually goes across society, includes the religious conservatives as well as the liberals, English and mostly Arabic. And they are talking about everything. They're talking about royal corruption. They're talking about the idiocy of the religious police. I don't know if how many of you saw The Economist's little story the other day about the dinosaur exhibit in a shopping mall and people mocking the religious police for trying to shut it down. And this is translating into public willingness to speak and to criticize and the like. The point here is that you are seeing the transformation of the nature, the stuff of politics, the relationship between citizens and the state, not only in the revolutionary countries like Egypt, but even in the most reactionary, seemingly stable countries. Does that mean that the Saudi king is about to fall? No, I don't think so. But it does mean that Saudi politics today look nothing like Saudi politics 5 years ago. And in a country where you have like 70% of the population under the age of 25, the highest rate of YouTube viewing per capita of any country in the world, some of the highest levels of internet use and penetration of any country in the world, it strikes me as a pretty good bet that this is going to matter somehow as Saudi politics unfolds over the next 5 to 10 years. So broadly speaking, I do see social media and the new media and this new citizen ethos as a structural fundamental change in the way regional politics works, but it's going to play out in lots of different ways, some positive, some negative, and I think it's good to have the corrective to overly optimistic narratives without then going too far in the other direction and simply saying, oh no, it's all bad, everything's going to be a disaster. What we're looking for, I think, is that middle ground of trying to really parse out how these mechanisms are unfolding, how they relate to one another, and then what it means for the kinds of political outcomes that we care about. So let me stop with that, and we can do this however you like. We can either have Sahar and Zainab answer all questions together, or I can take a few. It's really up to y'all.
Okay.
Sure. As you like. I realize I left my phone down there, so I don't know what time it is, so you'll have to cut me off.
I was just wondering about your point number four, the proliferation of information, the fact that gatekeepers have so much more importance in the world, filtering what information goes through the mass media, and I was really wondering, how is that different from the way mass media worked before, when journalists could just choose what they would cover and what they would not? Like, how is it fundamentally different with new media?
I think it's not fundamentally different, but that, in a sense, is the point, right? Is that we believe that there's been a fundamental transformation, and maybe it hasn't been as fundamental as we think. In other words, I think the ethos of much of the early commentary on the internet and social media was that the gatekeepers are gone, because now everybody has equal access. You can report information or express an opinion on Twitter, whether you represent a multi-million-dollar media company or you're, you know, a kid in his pajamas in the basement, right? That everybody can express their opinion, and then the kind of, I think the egalitarian, not even egalitarian, but I think the optimistic view of this, which I think is actually borne out by the early experience of the internet, is that you'll be then judged by the quality of your work, not by your identity. I mean, so for example, when I started blogging, I blogged under a pseudonym, anonymously, and in part, it was very useful to then be recognized and accepted as an expert, whatever that means, as useful, despite not having credentials, you know, because it was just an assumed name and the like. And so that's the optimistic story, right, is that quality will rise to the surface and people will find it if it's good. But I think that what's happened from the early days of the blogosphere and the early days of Twitter, it's like if there's 30 blogs out there, yeah, that works. But if there's 30,000 blogs out there, how do you find them? Well, you probably find many blogs today because Andrew Sullivan decides to link to them, or Glenn Reynolds decides to link to them enough times, and then people say, oh, this is good enough, I should follow this on my own. But would they have found it without those initial links? Probably not. So that's what I mean. It's not exactly the same as before, but it's also not as far away as it used to be. So you get Andrew Sullivan and Andy Carvin emerging as gatekeepers instead of the editors of the editorial page at the New York Times and the Washington Post, but they're still gatekeepers of a sort, or curators of a sort. I would say, though, by the way, that op-ed pages are completely useless now. I have no idea why people still publish them.
Gabriella.
Hi, yeah, thanks for that. That was really great. I want to ask about transition from spontaneous revolutionary defiance to that kind of institutional politics. And clearly there have been, in the last 100, 150 years, lots of instances of these kind of forms of radical protests. And thinkers like, James Scott and Francis Fox Piven have actually argued that, some really fundamental structural change requires these forms of, radical spontaneous defiance. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I want to hear or what I want to ask is, are there any insights that can be gleaned from looking historically with some of these other moments of revolution? And the medias they used in that moment of transition compared to the social media of today. Was there something about the pamphlets or different modes of circulation that tempered enthusiasm and facilitated that kind of transition for institutional politics? Or is it just too difficult to make that comparison because conditions were so different, let's just say, with the politics that preceded the push for unions, which had a kind of very revolutionary, spontaneous street moment before it transitioned into institutional politics?
That's a great question. And what I would say is that the short answer is yes, but it's more complicated than that. And what I would say is that the 150 years ago gets kind of a little bit about out of my comfort zone. In terms of trying to think through the appropriate comparative cases. But I like to look back at the transitions in Eastern Europe, the transitions in Central Europe, African transitions, Latin American transitions, kind of the stuff that, as political scientists, we kind of falls into our comparative universe. And what's interesting is that there's a really sharp divide in the literature. So if you look at the classic, O'Donnell and Schmitter, transitions from authoritarian rule, I would say there's a pretty heavy emphasis there on demobilization. Right? If you want to get successful transition, you need to get the elites into a room, they make an agreement, everybody go home, and you wait for your turn to vote. And that, from their point of view, when you have this kind of persistent, ongoing mobilization, it tends to be destabilizing and to undermine those elite agreements. But then you look at, you know, some of the work of, you know, kind of people like Bratton and Van de Waal, who studied the African transitions, or Mike McFaul looking at the former Soviet transitions, and they say, no, the most successful transitions were those where there was persistent, ongoing social mobilization, which prevented a relapse back into kind of old authoritarian habits. And so I actually think that the literature, the political science comparative literature, does not give any decisive answers on that. And so if you take that as your comparative starting point, and then you say, okay, let's say that it's kind of a wash in terms of whether or not it makes a transition to democracy work. Are there other functions which might be filled by persistent mobilization? And there I think the answer is unquestionably yes, in a positive way or a negative way. But let's focus on the positives. It might be, you know, as you're saying, you know, a chance for disruption, for keeping people engaged, that sort of thing. It might also be, you know, you look at like human rights activists in Egypt right now, they might be destructive of kind of everybody calming down and consolidating democratic gains, but by keeping a relentless eye on human rights violations, torture, failure to reform the Ministry of the Interior, by continuing to mobilize around those issues, they refuse to let them disappear from the agenda. And I think that's an extremely positive contribution, but not one which is necessarily linked to democracy or stability in any fundamental way. So my actual prediction is that across all of these cases, I expect activists to stay in the streets, at least in those numbers, on those kinds. And I think it's going to be disruptive, and it's going to be bad for democracy, but it might be good for kind of pushing for changed societal norms, changed institutional practices, and that, in a sense, that you know you just have to look at it from those different perspectives. But it's a really interesting question, because it's easy to get focused on just the one. What we want is justice, as opposed to what we want is a stable democratic system. And people have different goals. People care about different things, and they should.